Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Isn't it wonderful having the sun in your face, Robert?
Yeah, now that's Ann, just in case you're wondering, and this is Peter. Yes, it's nice to have a sunny day in Pittsburgh. We've had 3 of them in a row. Something must be wrong here.
Yeah.
We have 2 more coming up, heading up to Easter when we're recording this, which is really remarkable.
But then we had that whole week of them, and we're going to talk about our saga in Paso Robles.
Or Paso Robles, depending on who you talk to, and who better to set up the entire series of programs that we're going to present you with about this really rather wonderful and not terribly well-known region of Central California than Marianne Stansfield. Marianne works for Travel Paso Robles, and she arranged the entire week that we spent there for us and talked about the region from a general perspective to give you an idea of what's there, what we were going to see, and what we did see during the time of our visit. And we also, before we go to the recording, need to say on the air, thank you very much, Marianne Stansfield, for all the great work that you did in making sure that our trip went smoothly and that it was full of wonderful adventures.
And she was so much fun. Marianne Stansfield, you have the most interesting name of your company, Mental Marketing.
Yes,
I love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
And tell where it comes from, quit meeting you. You're so smart and funny and good sense of humor. It was great. And you're going to help us out here in setting up where are we, mm-hmm. what are we doing, mm-hmm. what are the highlights. Just go back. Paso Robles means avenue with oak trees.
It is actually in Spanish, it's El Paso de Robles, and that means the Pass of the Oaks.
Okay.
And this region was dubbed that obviously because of the oak groves, the numerous oak groves all throughout our region here in Paso Robles, which were in the foothills of the Santa Lucia Mountains, basically.
So that's why you have oak mm-hmm. trees, because, yeah, I never would have thought of it.
Beautiful
yeah.
rolling hills just covered with oak trees and, you know, vineyards now and cattle ranches. And just this has been an agricultural area this as far as
for centuries.
History. Yeah, and that's how this region was started. So
now it's coming out of, on its own as a separate, it's like the third largest wine growing region in California.
Yes,
ma'am. That's pretty major in a state that's a very big wine country.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And it's not lost on us by any means. We're very proud of that. And we're also the third largest and the fastest growing. What we have here is an agricultural region rich in wine grapes. Actually, the first grapes that were brought here were brought here by the Padres that were building the missions.
Mm-hmm.
We have 3 local missions here that were built, and they started
growing.
Oh, I hope
we get to see them. I love missions.
Yeah, that I hope so too, and actually I'm more than happy to drive you there.
Oh, great.
And so it's everyone thinks it's pretty new, this wine boom, but it's actually it's quite historical here on the Central Coast. What the newness is that over the past 30 years, people have been discovering it on a larger and a commercial level, and I think that we've had some bigger wine companies come down and buy up J.Lore and those kinds of companies come down and buy some vineyards. Meridian actually has a vineyard here as well. But we have over 200 wineries here, and a lot of them are boutique and really interesting. Yes, really interesting maverick winemakers that have moved to this region and are producing some spectacular, really unique wines that are different from what you'll find in Napa and Sonoma.
So the territory is very good for growing wine grapes.
Yes, sir.
Traditionally.
Yes.
Did the development here have something to do with the fact that Napa and Sonoma got so expensive?
It could have, but I mean, I wouldn't dispute that at all. I think that, Chris Toronto from the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance, it would be a great person to yeah. talk about that. He's the go-to guy about really all things wine here on the Central Coast. So I don't want to kind of position myself as the expert, but I do know that Gary Eberle was here 30 years ago,
yeah.
and he really paved the way. And so I think people started going, hey, what's that Eberle Winery doing and what's going on down there and how are they producing all these amazing wines? So there's something going on in the terroir down there. And so they started looking. And so the winemakers started kind of exploring, really found that we do have a really distinct and unique soil here that produces, quite frankly, those Rhone varietals are something that Paso Robles is becoming known for. And it's because of the specific soil here that's more prone to producing amazing Mourvedres and, you know, Roussanne and so forth. Although we do produce fantastic Cabernet as well, which I think Napa is much more known for. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we just had our fantastic Zinfandel Festival last weekend. And that is, you know, those were the vines that the Padres brought here. You know, those are the 100-year-old vines that we have here that are
amazing. So they were Primitivo relative Zinfandels that came like 5 centuries ago.
I would say 2 centuries
two
ago.
Centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is wine, and that's one draw for this region.
Yeah.
Another draw is, I would say, the culinary tourism with because of the wonderful products you have here.
Indeed, indeed.
And you have great restaurants, right?
Yes. So what happens is in come the winemakers and they're producing all this amazing wine. Well, all of a sudden chefs are going, hey, where are all these wines coming from? And chefs follow. They want to follow. They want to work closely with our winemakers. And that happens here all the time. You can find winemakers dinners and fantastic chefs working together, you know, creating amazing menus that people can come and experience and explore. And so the tourism angle of this whole region is just huge. And you're right, it's culinary and it ported. So we have these amazing chefs that you'll get to meet several of, and your listeners will hear a lot more about throughout your stories and your podcasts. But the region, the agricultural region, also supports what the chefs need to be dynamic.
Saying, we call this generally
Central Coast of California.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. California Central Coast, so
and there are great farmers markets and
indeed.
All that fresh produce. And then we also have the coast. We have the, I think on our agenda is it's the only abalone farm I know of.
Yes, it's farmed abalone, and I think that's another thing that kind of makes us a little more different than Napa as well is that we're only a half an hour from the coast, and so we have this amazing aquaculture thing going on. We also have an oyster farm down in Morro Bay, and the abalone farm in Cayucas got Hearst Castle, and they are huge, I mean, enormous proponents of grass-fed beef from Hearst Ranch.
And I never
Hearst
heard
Ranch.
Anything about this, it's the largest that size commercial provider of grass-fed and finished. I mean, it's
and
also
finished. Exactly.
Finished.
Yes, grass-fed and finished, which is key. Mm-hmm.
So this is culinary tourism. This is fully rounded culinary tourism is
indeed,
what's happening.
Indeed.
And so then there's the charm of these little villages. I mean, the center of town. I think coming in last night, Peter remarked that this is probably what some of the places like Sonoma and some of those cities were like back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here you call it the Central Park.
The Central Park, the Downtown Park,
Now, what they call it something different in Sonoma, Downtown Sonoma.
I don't know. I've been there several times, and I haven't caught that it has a specific name.
But it's much bigger.
Ours is bigger.
Yours is actually bigger.
Ours is bigger.
Sonoma's
is kind of small, actually.
It's small and compact.
But it's a whole lot
busier. I mean, we have sidewalks that crisscross through the downtown of our park, but I think they have places to sit and that kind of thing. Our park really is an entertainment center in town. I mean, we host events there, a year-round events calendar from a lavender festival to an olive festival to several wine festivals that take place. And so it's really, during the summertime, we have concerts in the park every Friday night, and so it's really highly, highly used park.
But for those who've been to Sonoma, Paso Robles has a different feel. It's much quiet. Sonoma loses something around Sunday lunchtime when it's swarmed with shoppers.
Sure, and tourists.
Here, I walked around this morning and it was very, very quiet. But I asked someone after I got back, I said, is it always this quiet? And they said, well, it never gets really busy.
Well, I think we do have several, as far as tourism is concerned, versus, you know, the town itself. I mean, it's a small town. The population here is 27,000. And so tourism population helps that to grow. And so at different times of the year, you'll see it get busier, of course, and seasonal as any is. But there are about 12 to 15 downtown local wine tasting rooms. We have olive oil tasting downtown and all of that. So on the weekend, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it kind of gears up. Today's Tuesday.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I was misled because it is. Because it was a Tuesday morning.
Tuesday, yeah. So, and then we have a beautiful Studios on the Park, this open studios. It's just a half a block from here.
What kind of studios?
It's an art studio where it's an open studio. There's 24 artists in residence.
Oh, I love that. I've been other places
fantastic.
Like that. Yes.
And it just opened last year. It's amazing.
So we're going to see that too?
You are.
Of course, artists tend to go to places where it's also very nice to live.
Indeed.
If you're not in New York, I mean.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And I guess that's why just all sort of snowballs. That's why also you have all these very charming little boutique-y shops around.
Right.
I want to be let loose on those.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to let you loose on the Studios on the Park because you really want to take your time through there because it's an amazing gallery as you're watching the artists paint and pot. And I mean, it's just, there's classes in the back, educational classes in the back for kids and whomever wants to, you can just walk in. If there's a class going on, you can sit down and start partaking. I mean, it's really set up.
And then I just saw there's a house tour, not a real estate tour. Apparently, there are a lot of houses suddenly
like
for sale.
Tours. Oh, yeah. Well, sure, sure.
We got this in our news at the hotel this morning.
Oh, you did.
There was a little thing that said, "Come on a foreclosure tour."
Tourism, the newest, greatest, latest thing.
Now's the time, and
sure.
Marianne Stansfield, of course, is the one who's responsible for letting everybody know that this is absolutely the bottom of the market. You have to buy now while you have the chance.
You know, Paso Robles, you know, that's another thing that sets us apart from Napa is the value here that you find, because I think that you're, as far as staying in a hotel, finding accommodations, how much you're paying for dinner, we have top-notch accommodations and culinary cuisine and wine, but we're not as costly as Napa Valley. I mean, you
they
can
had
come
on
here
the
and
Today
have the same
Show,
experience.
They had some sort of dream vacation segment, and it was talking about a place in the hills near San Simeon that was $50 a night.
Yeah.
And it was, what was it called?
I don't know.
I won't be able to spread the word. It's very hard to find and nobody.
A little motel?
Apparently.
A little inn.
Somewhere near his castle. It was on the Today Show we were watching this morning.
$50 a night.
Yeah.
In Charmin.
In San Simeon. Yeah. There's, you know,
it was
and
in
you
the
too.
Woods or something.
Interesting. Interesting. I can.
Hidden. But it's interesting.
And there's bed and breakfast dotted all over. Yeah. And there's some of our wineries have accommodations as well that are just unique and really spectacular. But as far as value too, I guess I started down that road because home values are really good too. So,
and who lives here besides all the people that we've just mentioned, like winemakers, artists, chefs? I mean, who else?
You know what? This is a really family-oriented community, quite frankly. My mother actually grew up here.
Okay.
Who else lives here are the farmers and the families of the farmers and the cattle ranchers and their families. It's a, like I said, a huge agriculturally historic district. And so, you know, when you're downtown or you're seeing, you know, kids running around in the park, I mean, they're the children of the winemakers and the olive oil producers here.
Because it's far enough away from a metropolitan area that you don't have, it's not a huge bedroom community.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now,
exactly.
How do you get here? Why don't we do that one too? First of all, what's the best website for people to go on to find out about the region?
To find out about the region, I would say travelpaso.com is going to be really comprehensive on Paso Robles and everything from that you can do here, from wine to agricultural to farm stays to, you know, family activities. But for wine specific ideas and events and things like that, there is a section of that on our website, but it'll also link you over to the pasowine.com.
Okay.
For really kind of more.
And I've got to practice this. I say Paso Robles and it's not. It's Paso Robles.
Paso Robles, yes.
Paso Robles.
Locals call it Paso Robles. And a lot of people want to say Paso Robles because that's the Spanish pronunciation.
It sounds more Spanish.
Yes. And it is, quite frankly. But the locals, it's Paso Robles.
Let's put this little dot on the map. the town of Paso Robles
is almost halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Yes.
Just off Route 101.
Yes, just off Route 101, and I would say southeast of Big Sur and Hearst Castle.
And if Carmel and Monterey already, you have no excuse not to come down here because that's about 2 hours away.
About two to three, just because of the way the highways go. Okay. You know, as a crow flies, it's always different, of course. But, yeah. So because basically along the coast is Highway 1, and that's the beautiful coastal highway that takes you through Big Sur. In between Highway 101, which is where Paso Robles is, and Highway 1 is the Santa Lucia Mountains. And so to get here, you know, you go over some really beautiful mountains where you can view the coastal regions. It's just amazing. So, but that's the connector. You want to get from the coast over to us, and it takes about a half hour.
So you fly?
Well, I was just saying, if you drive, then you can drive in 3 hours from San Jose and 2.5 hours from Monterey, in four hours from San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
Or would you fly into San Francisco and pick up a car? And or if fly you can, into
well,
Los
it depends. It depends if you want to drive for 4 hours. I mean, if you want to cut the time, as we did, then you connect and fly into San Luis Obispo, which is only about 30 miles away.
Indeed. Our regional airport here is really, it's so easy to maneuver through there. It's a good size. You can get direct flights from San Francisco or LA or Phoenix currently, and it's a 5 hour flight from either of those cities. Or, like Anne was saying, if you want to drive, which a lot of people do, they'll drive into one city and then drive down the coast.
Yeah, I've seen
some
people.
And then fly out of the other city. And so, we are, as Peter said, we're right dead smack in the middle. Yeah.
And I made a mistake in talking about this region earlier because this is not where Sideways was filmed.
No.
This is not Sideways. No. I was at Santa Barbara County. I was beginning to wonder why the hitching post wasn't on our itinerary, and then I realized I just made a mistake.
Right. So that's northern Santa Barbara County is the San Ynez Valley there where that was
so
filmed.
That's about an hour away. Next step heading south towards Los Angeles.
Indeed. Yes. So 2 hours south of here is Santa Barbara, and then 4 hours south of here is
This is the start of our adventure, and I look forward to tasting everything and sipping and
Marianne,
looking.
We have to thank you not only for talking to us, but also through your team organizing the entire visit for us. And we just know we're going to have a wonderful time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's our pleasure, and it's, like you said, a team effort with us and the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance, us being the Travel Paso Robles Alliance, and all the hoteliers here in town promoting tourism, too. So.
Yeah, that's the other great thing about this esprit de corps of this place, community spirit.
Yeah.
In all the different areas of it, the winemakers, the wines and the chefs. I mean, it's really a great community.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I like it here.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us and for everything you've done, Marianne.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Well, I mean, I can just say so much about this, but it's always, especially if you're going to be spending a lot of time with people, to find someone with a great sense of humor, who's not only efficient and professional, but also a lot of fun. Thank you, Marianne. And now it's time to go to a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're having a good time, aren't we, Rabbit?
We try to, but sometimes people make it easy for us because they're so well organized and they're full of such wonderful information.
And I think we should say, by the way, that if you're not a wine lover, you're going to be a little out of sync with this area of central coastal California.
Well, it is about wine. We'll find out later on in the subsequent program that there's quite an interesting food story in the region as well, but we'll save that for another day.
True.
But anyway, next up is Christopher Taranto, who's communications manager with the Paso Robles Wine Alliance, otherwise known as Paso Wine. So obviously what better person could there be to tell us all about the range of wines and winemaking styles and all that kind of stuff associated with the Paso Robles American Viticultural Area, otherwise known as AVA. So here's Chris. One of the things you always have to be careful of is when you're in the presence of a real expert, you find out that something you recorded earlier might not be entirely correct.
That's why I was wondering, because sometimes...
Fabulous starting point for an interview with Christopher Taranto.
who is communications manager of the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance. Welcome, Chris, to On the Menu Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we were talking just a few moments ago with Marianne Stansfield, and we said, how did grapes first come to Paso Robles? And she said, well, they were brought by the missionaries. Mm-hmm. Who settled and provided and founded their missions here, which there are several in the area. And she said, and we somehow decided that those grapes must have been Zinfandel.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out that's wrong. Chris, set us straight here.
What they brought along is the mission grape, and there aren't a lot of them left in this area. I think if you go to some of the missions, you might find some very old vines that exist there that very well could be the mission grape. We'd have to really get technical to look at its genus and species to really understand what its true origin is, but it's not the mission grape that really made it into...
No, you probably wouldn't really be very bothered about the wine that was made from mission grapes anyway.
Exactly.
It was something else.
It was absolutely something else. And then really what it ended up being that kind of got us started in Paso Robles is Zinfandel. The Zinfandel grape really found its way here through a lot of the Italian immigrants that ended up coming here in, well, the later 1800s.
Now, was it Zinfandel or was it Primitivo?
Okay, so that's a good question. It is highly considered to be Primitivo. However, it was a field blend. And so at the same time that Zinfandel or Primitivo was coming to the area, I think you were also having like Carmenere and a couple of those others that are often within that field blend, that Italian field blend.
Oh, okay.
So some of the oldest vines that you might find here, like out at the Ducey Ranch, that's where you can actually see some of that original field blend planting. You'll see that it's that blend.
But winemaking really took off in Paso Robles how long ago?
Really found its start back when Andrew York came to the area and founded the York Winery. That was about 1882, I believe it was, that the York Winery, it was the Ascension Winery that was originally established here. It still basically exists. It is a property that's still here, but it's not quite in continuous operation at the moment.
But the real growth has been happening within just the last few decades.
Definitely, yeah. Since the 1970s, when you saw some of the larger scale plantings and some of the bigger wineries really find their root here in the area, yeah, absolutely.
What do they like about this place? I mean, what is the terroir?
The terroir is really diverse in our area in that we have about 22 different soil types, for one thing, that exist here.
That's a lot. Yeah.
So it is quite a few different soil types that exist here. For the most part, what we have is a calcareous soil that is here. It's not quite limestone, but rather it's a type of soil that's calcified, sea bottom, basically, that hasn't quite gone through that intense pressure that limestone has gone through. So it's still very porous in nature, and what we have is almost a moonstone shape that exists on our stretch of coastline that stretches all the way through Paso Robles that brings to light this minerality that our wines, for the most part, can exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it a little bit like the red soils on limestone of the Coonawarra district in Australia?
Kind of, in the fact that is geologically a very significant area. It has truly its own soil type that we, I guess you could say, share in a sense, but our time period, I think, is where we are completely different.
Okay, so you're a different geological era in the production.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and because of which we have found ourselves to be very, really rather unique.
Well, that's pretty special. So Zinfandel did well here, but then some other grapes have also done well here.
Absolutely. Now, let's fast forward now, I guess you could say, into the 80s, where that's when everybody was Chardonnay and Merlot crazy, I guess you could say. And so then you have people that are finding land to be rather inexpensive here, finding even towards the east of our region, you're taking what was traditionally cattle grazing and that type of dry land farming. Now these large swaths of land, you can create large vineyards to create a lot of Chardonnay and a lot of Merlot and even Pinot Noir for that matter. And so that's kind of where we got a lot of that beginning stuff that through the late 70s and into the 80s. Then let's fast forward a little ways. And as we see science taking over and science coming into play, what grows best here, then we start to see some of those plantings, those original plantings, you know, going away. And being grafted over with varietals that are maybe a little bit more experimental in nature.
So I remember Gary Eberle told us that he single-handedly, he says, introduced Syrah into this area.
Great segue. You were asking what it was.
And there it is.
And there it is. It's Syrah. And Syrah really found its way into this area. And yes, Gary kind of introduced the more modern plantings of Syrah to the region. And it's supposedly the varietal. When somebody asks, well, what stock or what exact Syrah was brought in, he likes to say it's the Samsonite variety.
That's funny.
Because I guess, as rumor has it, he brought that
in a suitcase.
In a suitcase, yeah. So, Syrah definitely is one of those. Plus, they started to look at, during that same time, really how things were planted in our region. Maybe different trellising styles, maybe different orientations within, whether it's east, west, north, south. Little elements like that started to be refined. And so now, and then of course other varietals on top of just Syrah, but more of the Rhone style varietals, maybe some different white varietals.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have a group here called the Rhone Rangers.
Yes.
Rhone Rangers.
And they ride along on a white horse and say, Kimosabi.
And are you into this, in this region, into biodynamics that's sitting on the other regions?
You know, I think what it's funny, you'll hear some people in this area first and foremost say sustainable. And that's that whole sustainable messaging. Yeah. What they say is that they're sustainable because, well, they can continue to do business, so they're sustainable.
they're sustained. So they must be sustainable.
But really what it is that because the vineyard farming practice is so much a lifestyle and a choice for families and for multi-generations to be a part of, they have to farm that way. They have to farm sustainably.
Sure.
And then eventually, of course, they're getting into something a little bit more maybe biodynamic or organic in nature because they find that that might be more healthy for their environment that they're living within.
Now, so a lot of your members, they're like family businesses.
About 95%.
A really core devotion.
Definitely.
To creating something that's a family heirloom, a family treasure that's going on, in some cases, to the second generation already.
Absolutely.
But the new people starting out with the same kind of attitude.
They're coming here because they see a region that might fit into what they see themselves being or exhibiting in their own way. They are pursuing a life that is a little bit closer to family and closer to community, and that's what Paso Robles really is.
So that's the spirit of the place.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us about your organization.
They really live on the vineyards.
Let him tell us what his organization is. I don't know if the people intuitively figure it out.
Well, as so many industries that exist out there, I mean, industry, when you say industry for one thing, it just sounds so homogenized. But really, what it is, we are a community. We're a community of wine grape growers, winemakers, but also hospitality and just a community of general wine country well-being, I guess you could say. Our organization is the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance. We call ourselves an alliance because what we are is a member-based organization that all of these businesses join to help promote the brand awareness of Paso Robles wine as as a wine on the shelf, of course, but also as a wine region, so as a community for people to who want to experience wine country that they can come and visit.
You don't want to grow so much that in tourism you're going to be Napa, are you?
No, I don't think that's our goal. I mean, we really consider ourselves as something altogether different. We are Paso Robles. Granted, Napa is a wonderful community. It's fun to visit. Mm-hmm. They make great wines. We see them as our bigger brothers, maybe to the north. But when we classify ourselves, we often say we're the third largest and fastest growing wine region in California. Mm-hmm. And we're third, of course, being to Sonoma, one step above us, and then Napa above them.
So you, third place, being in third place isn't bad, I guess.
Not at all. Traditionally, this area as it stands, I mean, we were a lot more affordable. And that affordability of land and affordability of other things in general, when it comes to infrastructure or maybe capital investment, et cetera, helps a lot of our wineries then be affordable with their end product, being the bottles, being the wine.
Which is kind of important because we've heard recently people complaining that French wines are becoming price attractive because California wines, being Napa and Sonoma, are really too expensive.
Absolutely, yeah. The trend is trending down, basically, is scaling down your purchase so that way maybe a couple of years ago you would shoot for that $50 bottle of wine at the retail establishment or even more at a restaurant, and now you're spending a little less. Where we are sitting pretty as Paso Robles Wine Country is the fact that we have a high quality to value ratio. So if you go to the store shelf and you're purchasing a Paso Robles bottle of wine that might be priced at the $25 price range, you're getting a better value of wine that's within that bottle.
Right. Now, some of the giants from the north have come to this region anyway, right?
A couple, yeah. You know, they have, but they at least have allowed the wineries in this area to keep their own personality going, keep that alive.
There's one fascinating property which we're struggling over trying to remember the name of the parent winery in the Châteauneuf-du-Pape region. Between us, we got Château Bocastel.
Yes.
And they have a very intriguing venture here.
Absolutely. Tablas Creek Vineyard is very intriguing in the fact that they are solely a Rhone house. They came here, parent family and the Haas family, who were partners to begin with in an importing business. They came to the region and discovered it for those very qualities that I spoke of earlier, being that very calcareous soil nature, and sought to find a piece of land in this area that they can accomplish a new world application of Rhone-style wines. And they did with Tablas Creek. And they continue to get such great worldwide notoriety. They make such stellar wines. And they were, for quite a while, what's really interesting about Tablas Creek is that they were a nursery for those Rhone-style wines or vines that they were bringing through customs the appropriate way. So these vines sat in customs for many years to repropagate,
wow.
You know, so that way then they knew that they were completely void of any disease, et cetera.
Oh, okay.
Well, since then, they created this nursery to recreate these vines, and then from there, they created basically a TCV clone or a Tablas Creek Vineyard clone that so many other vineyards throughout California now feature in their vineyards.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And so that little kind of connection that we have has it really has a larger life in even beyond what Paso Robles is.
One of the things about them I find so interesting is that they've been very successful with their wines in the marketplace as well.
Absolutely.
When you compare with Opus One, mm-hmm. which was a similar attempt, a cooperation between French and American to build a Napa wine, you came up with a wine that was candidly far too expensive for most people's pocketbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And Tablas Creek has achieved, seems to me, the wonderful effort of a really fine quality product.
Yes.
At a price that won't frighten you away.
Absolutely. And, you know, the conscientious kind of attitude that they have too in what goes into their product is definitely reflected in the bottle. They have an organic vineyard. They have basically a business plan that is very obviously sustainable, but they carry that through into winemaking and into sales and into everything that they do. It's a fine example of a winery in Paso Robles.
That's terrific. Well, that's a fine example of a winery in Châteauneuf-du-Pape in France as well, incidentally.
Yeah. You have a complete schedule of wine events. You have very busy life here, don't you?
Yes, we do, yeah.
Now, give us an idea of what kinds of things you do.
Absolutely. So, you know, as
and when I mean you, I meant your organization, right?
They're one and the same thing. Yeah. So you just came off a big Zin weekend.
We did. We do 3 major events a year. 2 of them are these large-scale ticketed events. And as an organization, what we do is we try to, of course, extend the brand awareness of Paso Robles wines out in the marketplace, but also enhance the experience of wine enthusiasts' wine country experience within Paso Robles. By holding these events, we then, of course, make it kind of user-friendly for a wine enthusiast to come to Paso Robles and experience the region. Our kickoff for the year is Zinfandel Festival. It's always the 3rd weekend in March. We celebrate our heritage varietal that we spoke of earlier by doing so. And at this festival, it's all about Zinfandel within one big tasting, under one roof. Folks buy tickets, they come, they experience from about 50 different wineries what they make as far as Zinfandel and Zinfandel blends. And that's kind of a neat thing, too, is we're starting to see this trend of what we like to call Paso blends, is by blending, you know, the Rhone with Bordeaux, with Zin, with Petite Syrah, with even some Italian varietals or Spanish varietals. And now, instead of trying to make your best Rhone-style wine or Bordeaux-style wine or what have you, just trying to make the best wine possible.
You make the best Paso wine.
Exactly.
Now, so what comes after that?
After Zinfandel Festival, we go into May, actually, is the next big one. And that's the Paso Robles Wine Festival. Also, the 3rd full weekend in May every year. The Paso Robles Wine Festival is where we take our lovely 4.8-acre little downtown square park. It's, you know, very bucolic, very, oh gosh, it's, as many like to say, it's one of those picturesque, almost Midwestern kind of town, kind of environments that we have here in Paso Robles. And we pretty much stick 90 wineries in the park. we invite as many people as possible, but not really. I mean, we get about maybe 5,000 people that come and enjoy themselves in our park that day. It's a day-long series of events where folks can taste through the different wines of our wineries, chef demonstrations, seminars. We do a great big winemaker dinner and auction at the conclusion of the Saturday events. And then, of course, all of our wineries are doing their own individual events throughout the week.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. It's gaining a lot of notoriety out there, and it's a great event. I mean, it's always a beautiful day in May in our downtown square park.
Is it expensive to come?
Not at all. Actually, we make it quite inexpensive. We start at $45 for a ticket, and it goes on up to actually about right near $400. And that $400, of course, it includes everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and then there's one more?
Then there's one more. In the 3rd weekend in October, we have a event that basically celebrates harvest.
Got it.
Everywhere you go in this great planet of ours, you can celebrate harvest of something.
Yeah.
We're lucky in Paso Robles that it's not like broccoli or something. It's the grape. It's what we have here as our wine grape kind of industry. So what we do is we end up celebrating the harvest of wine grapes through Harvest Wine Weekend is what we call it. 3rd weekend in October. We don't have a ticketed event for this. It's actually something where you go out into the vineyards. It's the one time of year where things are really happening in the vineyards, and it's not just a bunch of plants in a nice even row, but rather it's purple grapes on the vine. They're being picked. They're being crushed. Things are happening.
Big bins of grapes being picked.
Exactly.
Tours where people get to actually blend and pick and stuff.
They get to do just about anything you want to do, actually, around here. We're still very much into that community feel. Our wineries love to get people out into the vineyard or into even the winery to experience something. Crushing with your feet or blending or, you know, if you really want to get put to work, you can do, you know, midnight pump overs if you really wanted to, I suppose. But really, it's a celebration of the grape. It's a celebration of what's happening, which is the new vintage.
Well, how do people find out about this? Where's the information?
It's all on PassoWine.com.
Okay.
Yes, so all you have to do is go to PassoWine.com, and you can find out just about everything you need to know about Paso Robles Wine Country. PASOWINE.
And just if you haven't already figured out from Chris's attitude here, this is a really dynamic wine-growing region. The growth's not going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah.
There are new people joining the organization all the time, new people launching themselves on a career in winemaking, and this is a place where you can still afford to do that.
Definitely. You can still afford to do it. You can still find that second life. Of course, there's always that little added saying, you know, you want to make $1 million in the wine industry, you got to start with five. but if you want to, or if you're seeking that type of lifestyle, if you're seeking that little closer to nature, closer to the earth lifestyle, and want to really want to get your hands dirty, absolutely. I mean, this is just a great region for that, if that's what your desire is. If you just want to come and taste some great wines and visit some neat startup wineries, some boutiques, and maybe even some of those brands that you know from your store shelf, this is a great place to come.
And we're going to meet some of those in this program and upcoming programs. Chris, we thank you so much for joining us today. We also thank you for being our generous host for our visit here to Paso Robles. And this is day one. I'm sure we're going to have a wonderful time. Thank you so much.
I sure hope so. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for having me on.
Well, Chris is interesting. Not only does he have the greatest job in the world, or at least a great job, he also knows not only about the wines, but also all the individual people who are unique personalities that are in the wine business in this area. And we're going to meet some of those when we come back. But first, we're going to take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, about to present to you an interview that we did with three of the most interesting personalities that we encountered in the winemaking of this Paso Robles. Three winemakers, Mark Goldberg,
who makes wine together with his wife and partner, Maggie D'Ambrosio,
who's a scintillating personality. She's just adorable.
She's about as scintillating as Mark is laid back. Stefan Esseo, who came all the way from Bordeaux with his wife, Beatrice, and a son who's off chefing in Las Vegas these days, but made it back home for the party that we were at the couple of days before we recorded this interview.
And that was some party.
That was some party. And then to complete the trio, Terry Hoag, who found his way into winemaking from playing professional football in the NFL. So if you want three rather different stories, you certainly got them all together.
And his wife, and Terry's wife.
Yeah, Terry's wife's name is Jennifer. Jennifer hails from New Orleans, and we're going to hook up with them probably in May when we're at the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. But the most interesting thing is that these three gentlemen and their spouses make wines differently for different reasons.
Yes, totally differently. But they're absolutely best friends.
And they're neighbors. They party together all the time, and I was very worried when we got them together in the same room whether we'd be able to control the interview. You'll be able to tell whether we did or not.
They're delightful.
Listeners, this interview is likely to spin out of control very shortly, but I want to start with some discipline. Here's a question that we're then going to answer. Right now it's a rhetorical question, but we'll get the real answer in just a second. What is a retired hospital administrator from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a Bordelaise, that's a Bordeaux-based in just winemaker, and an ex-professional football player with the NFL? What do they have in common? And the answer is they're neighbors, and they're friends, and they all make wine in a region of California called Paso Robles. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You forgot the most important thing. We all have beautiful wives.
Oh, I forgot that part. Oh dear. Oh dear. I'm forever destined to go to hell. And there was I just thinking about we would play the wine side of the game today. We probably don't have time for the tango lessons Terry and his wife teach, and the contests that they have. Each of you has a different story of how you came to this place and became friends. Would you like to share that with us?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a hospital administrator for 32 years.
And as a professional hospital administrator, I had to travel where the jobs were. But ever since I'm 17 years old, my hobby has been French Burgundy. I fell in love with that at your very old, but and I think now closed, Hollywood Social Club in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that's where I first had my experience with a Burgundian styled wine.
We're going to come back to a little bit of style points and things like that just a little bit later. But next, Stefan. Stefan probably made the most unusual transition from being a winemaker in a region of the world where they do things the traditional way to a place in the world where they do things a very untraditional way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I will say when I decided with my family to leave France and to leave specifically Bordeaux to end up to somewhere in the New World, the idea was to escape from the French regulation, because when you're in France, you have very heavy regulation, meaning that when you're in Burgundy, you do Burgundy. When you're in Bordeaux, you do Bordeaux. And after 17 years, I will say, repeating those roles year after year, I was kind of boring. And for me, make wine, it's more passion. And so I wanted to, I will say, express those passion. And the only way to do it was to make a big jump and start a new adventure in a place where I will have no regulation and I will be able to make the wine of my terroir, the wine of my place.
And that was quite a jump. And we'll come back to just exactly what was involved in that jump a little bit later. But we have a jumper on my right here who's used to defending a piece of turf 100 yards long and about 50 yards wide, and suddenly decided on a whole new career. Terry, tell us about it.
Well, I was introduced to wine actually by my wife. Her first date when I was playing for the New Orleans Saints was at a Flagons Wine Bar, which is no longer there, in New Orleans. And I had gone to the University of Georgia, so I was a beer guy before that. And she definitely had a passion for food and wine. It wasn't really until I started playing for the Philadelphia Eagles and became friends with George Perrier, who owns Le Bec Fin.
Oh, okay. So George had a role there.
George and his sommelier at the time would take me on these wonderful tours through wine country when I would go in, and they would just bring me all these amazing bottles and just start pouring wines. And I really started to enjoy it. And when I played for the 49ers, I was able to actually visit Napa, which was the most proximate area. And when I retired from the NFL, my wife and I did a couple of different things, and my wife had a business, but we decided in 2000 to pick a new place to raise our kids. And we discovered Paso Robles and Templeton purely by happenstance and picked our family up and moved here. And after moving, discovered that this was one of the most up-and-coming, exciting wine regions in the world. And I was able to use that as a jumping off point to get into wine.
So it wasn't anything like a deliberate approach. It just sort of happened.
No, my life has always happened to me.
Unlike Stefan, who did this for his entire career, and Mark, I'm not really sure I still understand all of the excuses that you have. But you decided, each of you decided on a slightly different style of wine, even though you're neighbors. And Mark, perhaps you made the most unusual choice for Paso Robles. Tell us about that.
Well, I had been searching all over for a piece of land that would support a traditional Burgundian style of making Pinot Noir, because I was disenchanted with the direction that the New World Pinot Noirs were taking, in that they were a little later harvested, they were dark and they were plummy, and they didn't reflect the 1,500-year-old tradition of Pinot Noir in Burgundy and how that all developed. And so we sort of stumbled on this little piece of land that was a barley farm in El Paso de Robles. And I found out, because everyone said at that time, it's too hot, Pinot Noir will not grow there. And then I lucked into a bottle of Stan Hoffman's 1976 Pinot Noir that was made in Paso Robles, and also received accolades in a tasting in France. And the reason he planted Pinot Noir, that was the first Pinot Noir probably planted in the Paso Robles appellation, was because his consultant was André Tchelchef. And so André told him, this is Pinot Noir country. And the people at that time were taking their temperatures at the airport, and it's much hotter there. So we decided to go ahead with it anyway. If I could get close to that 76 Pinot Noir, I was going to be a happy guy.
And Windward being the name of your property sort of indicates the importance of wind coming from a particular direction in order to make a Pinot Noir successful.
Right. It's the Pacific influence is very, very important. It doesn't grow well on the east side. Now, it grows well anywhere, but it doesn't make a great wine on the east side.
Now, Stefan, you came from a wine-rich culture already, although you said that you found it limiting. And here in the New World, you found the opportunity to do something totally new. But why Paso Robles in particular?
Oh, why Paso Robles? It's a long story, you know, because somewhere, to make a long story short, I will say after visiting Napa, Sonoma, Monterey, Santa Barbara, I ended up to Paso and I fell in love to Paso Robles. And so we're a neighbor, like you said, so we're on the west side of Paso where the climate is very, very different because it's a big AVA. So somewhere, however, where you are from the ocean, you will have a different kind of climate, and the notion of microclimate in Paso Robles is very, very important. But also to come back about l'aventure, I will say, all the idea leaving Bordeaux was not to make a copy of Bordeaux in Bordeaux. I could stay in Bordeaux to make Bordeaux. It's a good place to make this kind of wine. So somewhere, I would say at the opposite of Mark, the idea was, like I said, really to try to make, even it's a little bit pretentious, but take advantage, I will say, of the microclimate of Paso Robles, where we can grow most of the varietal, which are able to give really the maximum of their characteristic, and from that try to create a wine will be representative of Paso. So I'm not saying that L'Aventure and my crazy blend of L'Aventure or representative of Paso, because you will see just three of us playing three different or make three different wines. But at least I will say L'Aventure, it's one expression of Paso, and I like the idea to be able to make a wine which is very specific, I will say, or it's at least my interpretation of my microclimate of Paso.
Now, you said something really interesting. You said the property that became L'Aventure, when you got there, you just knew this was the place.
Yeah, I fell in love. So it was, I will say honestly, it was a good feeling, but it was, everything started, I got a good feeling, and year after year I understood, even I did some solo analyze. I remember I rented a backhoe, I did some ditch because I wanted to have the visual side of the soil, but honestly I didn't know everything about the complexity. We're speaking about the climate and microclimate of Paso Robles, and even I didn't know, I will say, everything, I really felt this place. Maybe for some people after this interview they will come to visit us in Paso. If they end up to L'Aventure or to Mark Place or Terry Place, they will see that the beauty of the place, and honestly I fell in love to the place. I felt at the first time that was the spot where eventually I will live for
Right, you said you lived in a mobile home for 10 years and right next door to it you built this wonderful home where we had the wonderful party the other night. Now Terry, your journey into making wine we understand a little bit more about now, but you certainly didn't know anything about making wine. And how did you pick the place?
Well, we picked the place to raise our children. I mean, it was purely based on what we felt would be best for our family. And the original move was wonderful for our children. It's the place that we were looking for to have our kids grow up. After we discovered the place for our kids to grow up, we discovered that it was also a wonderful place for my wife Jennifer and I, because we could reinvent ourselves in this up and coming industry in Paso. I come from the outside and from a completely different perspective. I feel unencumbered by a lot of the rules and regulations and histories of winemaking and come to it. It's all fresh to me. And it's really nice to have the resources that we have here. The guy who taught me how to make wine was a guy named Justin Smith, who owns a label called Saxum. Dad has been farming here for years, and he makes amazing wines. But I also have the ability to appreciate the history that Mark has, the technological history that Stefan has in Bordeaux, and start to embrace those but come to it from a totally different perspective. The way I got into it was I walked into a bar. It sounds like a bad joke, but I walked into Via Creek one night after Jennifer and I got into a fight, and she kicked me out of the house, and I said, fine. And I went to the Zen Fest, and after the Zen Fest, I didn't feel like going home yet. So I walked into Via Creek, and there was sitting a bunch of up-and-coming winemakers, and I sat down at the table with them and enjoyed their company, enjoyed the wines that they made, and slowly started the progression from kind of outside the business and starting to get into the business. And my first foray was with a small plot of land that I started farming. And when I started farming it, I realized that I loved farming, that I truly love farming. And that's my passion about the whole process. My wife has a history of wine that goes way back, but she started drinking wines when she was living in Paris. And so she has a more European palate, a more European sensitivity. So I think we have a nice yin and yang in our property, in that we're always kind of fighting for the thing that we're passionate about in wine. And I think it makes a very nice balance.
Now, you actually taught yourself to be a winemaker, though.
Well, I was taught by Justin Smith, and you know, I have a history in science. I got a BS in genetics, so I had a lot of organic chemistry, a lot of chemistries, a lot of botanies, and so kind of the general concepts of winemaking is not foreign to me. But the actual practice of it, and actually the art of it, because I've found what I thought would be an extremely scientific, and it has science. Is the basis of everything, but it's art. I mean, it's your own perception, yes, of what you're creating and how you're taking it from one point to the other. And I think that's the thing that I enjoy about it, because, you know, playing professional football, people don't necessarily think that it's artistic, but you know, it's really an artistic expression of your body. I mean, it's using your body in an artistic way, and although a very violent way a lot of times. And this is the same. I mean, this is an expression of artistic expression of your palate, of your tastes, of the things that you enjoy, of passion and pleasure.
But it's also caring about growing things too. And Mark, you must really feel for that, because you wanted to produce something so special that the plantings that you made and the way you took care of them really had to be really special.
Well, that's certainly true. I knew, however, exactly what I wanted the results to be. I had a very, very clear vision. I wanted to make a great American Burgundian-styled Pinot Noir. So that was my vision, and it enabled me in early 89 or so to meet with Kenny Volk, who was making some Pinot Noir in Paso Robles, Wild Horse. And Kenny helped me get started. He made one barrel for me from clones that I had selected from the hundreds that he had already vinified. And the four clones that I selected, he made into one barrel for me, 20 cases, and it was called Wild Horse Windward Cuvée, because I had already started to name the vineyard. I still have 6 bottles of it, and we had a bottle not too long ago. It was excellent.
Was it good? Mm-hmm. It was really good. Okay.
So I then purchased and sourced the 4 clones at a nursery and had them promulgated, and then I planted them in the vineyard. So I have 4 blocks of clones. One's from Chambertin Clos de Bays in France, the other's from Romanée Conti, one is from Pommard, and the other is a clone 13.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Now, Stefan, you're making wines with what kind of grape composition?
Well, like I said, you know, L'Aventure, it's a crazy blend, and one of my flagship wines, the name is Estate Cuvée, and so it's a Syrah Cabernet Petit Verdot blend. And so it's very original, because I'm not the first one, I will say. Even I didn't know about that, but Australian people already were used to blend Syrah and Cabernet Sauvignon. But I will say the personal touch is definitely the Petit Verdot, which is in Bordeaux, because it's from Bordeaux. And most of the time, I will say in Bordeaux, it's not ripe every year. But here, because this beautiful climate we have in Paso Robles, we're able to have the maturation of this grape. And so I think that this blend is working not too bad. But I would like to come back about what Terry said. You know, he said that he was in love more with viticulture, farming process, and the winemaking, and I will share that with him. For me, and it's not a fake modesty. You know, I think that the growing side is 80% of the story. So first, you need to have the, what we call in France, the terroir, which is the combination of the climate, the microclimate, the soil, the topography of the place, etc., etc. But on the top of that, you know, you're not able to make great wine from mediocre fruit. So the only way to have a chance to make a great wine, even you're the best winemaker in the world, is to grow and to harvest some beautiful fruit. And so I will say that if you go across the world, every time where you meet or you taste some fantastic wine, behind the wine you have a fantastic grower, you know. And that's, for me, it's very, very important. And that takes 80% of my energy, 80% of my money, and 80% of everything. 20% after is the wine making and the maturation in barrels up to the bottling.
Now, your wine is mostly, is a red, the cuvée is a red.
Yeah, it's a red wine. You know, I have a few red wines, and I do a very confidential, very, very small volume of Roussanne, which is Rhône, South Rhône varietal. Most of the time, you know, is in the composition of some Châteauneuf-du-Pape Blanc, because a lot of people know about Châteauneuf-du-Pape Red, but in Châteauneuf, they produce some fantastic Châteauneuf white, and Roussanne with Grenache Blanc is one of the two main grapes. And so I like this wine. It's more, I like this grape because that doesn't make some very flashy, aromatic wine, but the Roussanne can, when you have the terroir, can express really the minerality of the terroir with some white fruit flavors. But it's, at least the one I'm doing, it's more a food wine with a nice acidity than an aperitif wine.
We understand that you are also approaching biodynamic.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny because today, you know, I was in a hurry because I did my first spray of preparation on the ground, and you have to steer the preparation at the right time. But this year, after having done that by hand, I built a machine who make my life easier. So because it's kind of crazy and very complex, but I'm just starting, so I'm very humble about that. Before to make the move, I met the last 6 years some people from Burgundy, from Bordeaux, from Oregon, from Washington State, and finally last year I took the decision to make the move because everybody was, I will say, positive and very happy about the result of this practice. And somewhere also the idea and all the philosophy about that, it's to be organic first, because all of us, when we arrived to this beautiful land, the land was completely virgin, we had a beautiful ecosystem, everything is in place, and I want that when I will retire today to let the place clean like it was, even somewhere during 25 years I did some wine and I grew some vines from this land.
Now, what's in the future for Terry?
Oh, I just would like to speak a little bit about I think all three of us here, to a certain extent, are organic or near organic. I think we're all trying to be great stewards of our properties.
And yeah, I believe in try to practice sustainable agriculture, but biodynamics I don't do because it requires Stefan to run naked through the vineyard when the full moon is out in order to get the plants stimulated.
And Mark
I don't
doesn't
like the cold.
You don't want any competition. Mark wants to run naked by himself through the vineyard. He doesn't want any company.
Listen, did I tell you this interview would get out of control? I think it just did. And Stefan has to go stir his potion, his biodynamic potion. So what I'll do is I'll ask each of our guests to give us a last thought, starting the opposite way we did the last time. So, Terry, you're up first.
You know, I feel my life has been unbelievably charmed to have been able to do all of the things that I've done in my life and then to end up in Paso Robles with such good friends, with camaraderie and the opportunity to do something entirely different and be able to find a way to do it successfully. I mean, what's in the future for Terry Hook Vineyards? And, you know, my wife and I will hopefully die on the property. I mean, we love it here. We love what we're doing. We're both passionate about what it is that we're doing, and we're trying to do the very best thing that we can. I personally like this opportunity that I've gotten to explore and express myself in a different manner. And you know, I hope I continue to learn and make great wines.
Knowing Terry's wife, Jen, I'm sure that he may die on the property sooner than he expected to. she's a real fireball.
She seemed like such a nice lady to me. And let's conclude with Stefan talking about his absolutely charming wife, Beatrice.
Oh, but definitely, you know, if we did this big, jump from Europe and this big adventure, it's because somewhere it was a family choice. It was not just, my selfish choice just to make wine in a different place. So when we moved, everybody was agree. I think we were lucky enough to end up, not just like I explained, in Paso, because the land is fantastic to grow beautiful vines, but somewhere we are lucky because Paso is a great community. I think you spend 3-4 days, and pretty sure you enjoy most of the different aspects and the complexity of this micro-society between farmer or retired people. Well, we have a fantastic climate. It's a great town. So I'm very happy about, to live in Paso because, you have the wine, which is a big part of my life, but you have also the day-to-day. And that's very important. And Mark wants to add something.
I just wanted to remind you that I spent my first 40 years of life as a Pittsburgher, lived in Shadyside and Squirrel Hill. So I'd like to say hello to all my friends back at home and invite them to visit Windward Vineyard anytime they're out the coast.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And
giving props to your peeps.
Okay. Yeah, I can't let this go without a football connection for Terry. I know that many of us in Pittsburgh said if the Steelers couldn't win the Super Bowl, we were so glad the Saints did.
Who dare?
And I bet you feel the same way.
My wife's from New Orleans, and so having played there, both of our phones were hoodatin'.
Hoodatin'. Well, thank you to all three of you for joining us. Thank you for a wonderful evening that we all had together the other day as well. And we wish you continued success with everything that you're planning.
Just to recap, the three vineyards are Windward, which is Mark and Maggie's place, L'Aventure, which is Stefan and Beatrice's place,
The Adventure, which it really was for them,
and Terry Hogue Vineyards, where Terry and Jennifer make wine. So that's just in case we forgot to mention it in the interview. I'm not sure whether we did. So now you have it twice, or at least once. And
and Scott, the wonderful chef who produced food from a 30-mile radius.
It's actually Jeff Scott.
Jeff Scott.
Not Scott Jeff. maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. I've been wrong a lot today, but maybe I'll do better next week.
But I mean, can you imagine being able to source all those ingredients for that big feast within a 30-mile radius? Amazing.
Well, it wasn't all within a 30-mile radius. He let on that the frisé came from out of the region because I guess it wasn't available locally. But it was fun. If you meet these characters, you'll have fun talking to them. They're just a sample of the wonderful characters who have settled this region and grown the number of wineries from 12 to now, I think, 219.
Oh, boy.
And you'll be talking to some of them, or you'll be listening to some of them in next week's program and possibly also the week after. So stay tuned. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.